Right, just before we get started, we've had an idea, haven't we, John?
We have had an idea because we, as you will probably know by now, we like to do a very big competition every year. And the competition will be, not for a little while, be, when are we talking, Tommy? Probably starting September.
I think, is it? Yeah.
But what were we thinking, Tom?
We were thinking we can't be arsed coming up with an idea for the actual... Is that... Are we not saying that?
Should we pretending it's should like we, a, yeah, let's phrase it differently.
We want to give you the opportunity...
There you go.
Is that better? ...to be a stakeholder in the competition by coming up with the genre idea theme. So previously we've had we had a Halloween one.
Love story competition.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the kind of themes we're looking at. So I don't know. What other themes could you come up with? Come up with another theme. And we'll put them all in a hat and pick one out at randomish.
Yeah.
So if someone, if someone's sending in silly stuff, we're not having that. If it's like Muppets or something, we're not having.
Actually,
can't
that's
do that.
Quite good.
I don't know the trademarks and stuff.
Oh yeah, that's a good point.
So,
yeah.
We need to be careful, don't we?
We do. Yeah, we don't want to get the lawyers involved.
But we would love your idea just to get a really different slant on something. So it's
Exactly. And also, if the same thing keeps coming up, then that's obviously what you want to write about.
Yeah, we might have tapped into the zeitgeist.
So yeah, we thought we'd throw it out.
Maybe
there.
Zeitgeist. Maybe that's the
zeitgeists.
Theme. Zeitgeists. Yeah. No, it could be anything. Could be anything. Mountains, dogs, lawnmowers, whatever.
As long as it's not AI.
Not AI, and probably not love or Halloween as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. How are we going to make sure we don't get AI entries into the competition?
Well, I think we just have to trust everybody.
Yeah, yeah. I've just a horrible thought if we like pick a winner and then we phone them up.
We
find
out.
Like, hello. Yes, I am definitely a person.
There was a photography competition, wasn't there, that AI won?
Right.
Not that long ago.
Yeah.
And then someone fessed up and said, actually, I was doing that to make a point. Honest.
Right, that old chestnut.
Yeah.
Oh, now you've caught me. Yeah, no, it was a thing. Very much was a thing.
But ideally don't get AI to write it because, I mean, it's not going to be as good anyway, is it?
Well, that about covers it, doesn't
it? Yeah. So where should they send it, Tom?
Send it to failingwriterspodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah. Or tweet it.
Tweet it.
Yeah. We will be putting out a tweet
anyway,
but send it over.
Yeah, send it
It'd
over.
It'd be really interesting to find out what you'd like to write about.
Yeah.
To be fair, our themes are pretty loose anyway, aren't they?
Yeah, but it's nice to, we like to have a bit of fun with them as well. So it needs to be something that's relatively open to interpretation, but it's good to have a theme to work within, isn't
something
it?
To work on,
So if you could do that, that'd be brilliant. And then
that'd be lovely. That'd save us a job.
Get your pencils sharpened for the competition in a few months. Anyway, enough of that.
Mm.
On with the show.
Continue.
Hello there. I was just helping Trevor the Tortoise put on his socks. It was nothing more sinister than that, and if you think you saw something different, then I suggest it's you who has the problem. Anyway, welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast. Isn't it lovely? Certainly nice to see you. Now, on this week's programme, we've got a little treat for you. Can you guess what it is? Well thought out comment and intelligent conversation? No, not quite. The boys are reading the start of a children's book that they've written as a special task after talking to Jack Meggett Phillips, a real writer who's talented. So, how do you think they got on? Maybe they will have written something wonderful, like the next Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, or the next Gruffalo. Or they could both be a big steaming pile of monkey plop. Let's find out, shall we? I think we already know. Welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast.
It's been a long while, John, since we've done a task on the podcast.
I know, I was aware of that as well.
And
which is why I was pushing us into doing one.
And it's funny, I was thinking it's funny how after all this time of not doing a task, how we just slip straight back into the same thing of desperately swimming upstream against deadline.
Yeah, leaving it to the absolute last minute, you mean?
Yeah.
Would you want to tell the listeners when I sent mine to you?
Well, I think I pretty much just received it, John. I think it's fair to say.
It's about 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that. Listen, this week is going to be like story time, isn't it?
It's going to be like Jack and Ori. Jack and Ori, that's exactly what I was thinking.
We've got a whole bunch of stories today. We've got like the beginnings of stories. We've got short stories. We've got kid stories. We've got not kid stories. We've got good stories, yeah. Bad stories, more stories.
We have. So here's a storytelling episode. So yeah. Are you sitting comfortably, listener?
Yeah.
And if you are, then we'll begin. So first up, we had Jack Meggett Phillips on the show a little while ago, and he's a middle grade children's writer.
Mm-hmm.
And we set ourselves a challenge to write the start of a children's book.
We did.
Didn't we? And interestingly, because we interviewed Jack quite a while ago now, and he kind of inspired me to think, well, maybe I'll try that. Maybe that's my thing.
Mm.
So I had actually started writing a children's book.
That's right.
But then I thought, well, I can't do that one because A, that'd be kind of cheating. And B, I don't want anyone stealing the idea because it's really good. So I've done a completely different one, which was actually quite an interesting thing to do because I thought it might be tricky. I thought I might have exhausted my children's book ideas.
Mm.
But a little one popped up. I was quite pleased with it.
I was actually assuming that it would be quite a difficult task for you, Tom, and that you'd do the same as me. You kind of leave it to the last minute, not be able to think of anything, and then just sort of dash it off. But that's not really what happened with you, is it?
No. I cheated a little bit in that I lent on an idea that I had previously. But yeah, it seemed to fall into place quite quickly.
That's nice for you, isn't it?
It was. It was really easy. I would go as far to say it was pretty easy. Pretty easy. And I didn't really sweat it and got it all done comfortably in time.
Wow. Oh, that one, I'm really pleased for
if you can imagine
really
that, John.
For you, man.
So what we can do, we're just going to read them and then just...
Yeah, let's do it. If listener, you have taken me up on my suggestion from last episode of bringing a young person along for the ride.
Oh, yeah.
Then, please be reassured that we're keeping like the first half of this podcast very pure and clean for more sensitive ears. However, in the second half of the pod, which we will warn you is approaching, the stories being shared are not going to be appropriate for tender-eared listeners.
And so, we will be talking about your judges' feedback as well, John, so I doubt that's going to be particularly...
that's not going to be appropriate.
That's going to have some choice language in, I would imagine.
So I just thought we'd cover that off now, but don't worry, we'll warn you ahead of time before we lower the tone. So, bring the kids into the room now, I would say. Should we start with you, Tom?
Yeah, we can do. I mean, mine's turned out a bit long, really. I was going to read a shorter bit of it, but then it needed all of it. It needed the first chapter,
I think,
really.
It does. Yeah, I think
just
it does.
Just to roll through.
It's great. It goes in a flash, Tom.
So here's what I wrote. Have a listen. The Genie in the Loft by Tom Turner, or whatever it might be called. I'll still be called Tom Turner, but the title might change. Might not be The Genie in the Loft. Chapter 1. The Great Bartholomew. Grace was not allowed in the loft. There were lots of rules which her parents had come up with, like don't put chocolate milk on your cereal. If you're not up by 10 o'clock, there's no breakfast. And don't dye the cat's fur pink, stick an ice cream cone on its head and spend an entire weekend insisting that she's a unicorn. But the strictest rule of all was don't go in the loft. In fact, Grace wasn't sure she'd ever seen anyone go up those rickety stairs up to the top floor of their old Victorian house. Even her dad. She'd asked him once what the big secret was. She was brave like that, was Grace. Not shy at all. Her mum and dad said that she must have got all the chatty, gregarious genes because her younger brother Shay wouldn't say boo to a goose. Grace didn't know what gregarious meant, or why shouting at a goose would be particularly impressive. But she, somewhat incorrectly, got the general gist that it basically meant she was her parents' favourite and Shay obviously a distant second. But no matter how brave Grace was in asking her dad about the loft, his rather poor parenting technique of dodging any tricky questions by distraction with an ice cream or chocolate bar always seemed to do the trick. A parenting technique that Grace happily took advantage of sometimes. In the mood for a chocolatey treat? Just ask Dad an awkward question about where babies come from. And sure enough, just like magic, a chocolate bar appears. So, the loft was hidden behind a dull wooden door at the top of a narrow staircase and remained a mystery never to be uncovered. That was until Tuesday. On Tuesday, Grace got back from school as usual. She'd walked home with a friend Maeve and her mum, Mrs. Jackson, as usual. Came in through the front door, chucked a bag down in the hall, Got told off by a mum for dumping a bag in the hall, as usual. Went upstairs to get changed. Walked past Shay's bedroom in the bottom of the spooky loft staircase, as usual. For some reason, glanced up the loft stairs to see the door ajar, as you... Ooh, hold on. That wasn't as usual, was it? That was very not blooming usual. Grace would go so far as to specifically use the word unusual about this very circumstance. And that is exactly the opposite of usual. Grace's mouth opened and she took in a little breath, ready to instinctively shout downstairs to Mum to let her know the loft door was mysteriously open. But of course, this being Grace, the shout never left her mouth. Never even got as far as halfway up her throat, if we're honest. What was going to be a loud shout down the stairs instantly turned into a rather quiet, ooh, which was what Grace was saying to herself as she realised that after all these years, she might be able to finally see what was in the loft. What was the big secret? She'd once told Shay that it was haunted by the ghosts of Victorian servants who used to live up there in the olden days, and how one of them had died a horrible death. Then she'd been told off by a mum for scaring Shay. Grace had said sorry and told him that it was all made up and silly and that he shouldn't be scared as there are no such thing as ghosts. But now, looking up at the long, narrow staircase, she was starting to wonder. Maybe there were. Maybe that's why her mum got so angry about her spooky stories. Too close to the truth. That's why her mum and dad had kept it locked all these years. "I've got to go and tell mum straight away," was exactly what Grace didn't think as she started to slowly creep up the stairs to the loft door. She gently placed one foot up on the next stair and the next until she'd left a dusty little trail behind her all the way to the top. Her eyes focused on one thing and one thing only. The door. The very same door she'd looked at and wondered about for more than half of her life. Probably more than half of her life if you were actually to do the maths, which she wasn't going to because she hated maths and, quite incorrectly, thought it was for nerds. Grace took in a purposeful breath and reached tentatively forward, gently allowing her hand to rest upon the cool round brass doorknob. It was dark inside through the crack. Well, mostly dark. As her eyes adjusted, she could see that there was some light in the loft, maybe coming from a crack in the roof or small window. She pushed her arm forward, slowly swinging the door on its hinges. She didn't know what to expect. A Victorian servant ghost sat with their feet upon the bed? A vast hoard of treasure overflowing out of a wooden pirate chest? Stacks and stacks of antique manuscripts and books, maybe? Or a room completely empty except for a mysterious safe right in the middle? Nope. It was none of these. It was, well, just your typical loft. There were a few boxes, some bags of old clothes, bit of broken old furniture, that sort of thing. With a tiny sigh of disappointment that she wasn't, right now, having a good old chat with someone called Edith, who was born in 1863, Grace tiptoed further into the loft just to check that there wasn't anything more exciting. Which, unless you get particularly giddy about bags of old green and brown furry curtains from the 1970s, there wasn't. Adventure over and years of anticipation and imagination down the drain, Grace turned to make her way back to the door, still being smart enough to step gently so as not to creak the floorboards and give away her position to Mum downstairs. Watching her feet land daintily, much like she imagined a professional ballet dancer would if they were gracefully avoiding the cracks in the pavement so their granny didn't die, she got about halfway back to the door and something shiny caught her eye. Well, it wasn't exactly shiny. It was quite dull in a way, really, but it was somehow very eye-catching. An unpolished, golden, brassy colour with some exquisite curves. Grace couldn't help but stop and pick it up. It felt so weighty and solid in her hand, and she wondered why on earth Mum and Dad would have such a nice, expensive gravy jug and just keep it in the loft. If they gave it a bit of a clean, it would look really nice. And they could put it on the shelf in the dining room where they kept the other bits and bobs. They could definitely swap it for that stupid pottery dog with its tongue sticking out, or the random massive seashell they kept on there. They said it was a reminder of an adventure when they were younger. As if Mum and Dad ever had an adventure, thought Grace, disbelievingly. The fancy gravy boat almost felt like it was looking straight back up at her, as her face reflected dully in its side. Grace pulled a few funny faces, its curve acting like a funfair mirror, where they make you look tall or small or wobbly or like your head is 4.5 foot long. She pulled the sleeve of her school sweater over the heel of her hand and gave the old gravy boat a bit of a polish so she could see her hilarious face-pulling antics a bit better in the half-light of the loft. 3 or 4 good rubs and it was starting to shine up a treat. She moved her hand further round. She could get the whole thing looking as good as new in no time. Poof! A huge spurt of dust coughed its way out of the end of the gravy boat, rattling the lid and making Grace jump so much in fright that she let go of the jug and it fell onto a box of old magazines, resulting in even more dust poofing up in her face. Cough, cough, went Grace, which wasn't unexpected, as we just said. There had been quite a bit of dust. Cough, cough, went the gravy jug, which was unexpected, as it was a jug. What? Said Grace to herself. Although she wasn't 100% sure, she might have been talking to the jug, which was ridiculous because it was a jug, but then it had just coughed. Before Grace had any further chance to question who or what or why she was talking to, the jug said, Hello. Hello? Said Grace. Still not sure that this wasn't all some kind of trick or old toy or a ghost or a recording or no, she really was struggling to get to grips with what was going on here. She would have no doubt carried on trying to work out what was going on if she hadn't been completely distracted by the sound of the jug making noises like, well, I'm afraid there's no other way of saying this, like someone really struggling to go for a poo. Straining, groaning, ing. Yep, there was something in there and they really were trying hard to get out. Maybe a mouse had got caught in there, thought Grace, for a split second, until she remembered that mice generally don't say hello. Silly idea, she thought, but whatever was actually happening could only be a great deal sillier. With a poof and a pop and a plop and a shlop, there was another huge cloud of dust and smoke. When Grace fanned it away with her arms, there, stood right in front of her on the box of magazines, was a little man. They stood and stared at each other for what Grace thought must have been around 5 minutes. It was, in fact, roughly 12 seconds. Hello, said the little man in a flamboyant, generic European accent that Grace couldn't really place. Maybe Italian? A bit Spanish? Moroccan? Hi. My name is the Great Bartholomew. I'm Grace. You look familiar, Grace. Have we met before? Probably not. I think I've been in there, he said, pointing slightly annoyed towards the jug. For about... Ooh, he looked up in the air as if looking for the answer. About 40 years, I reckon. In there. Yep. 40 years in a gravy boat. What? A gravy boat? This is not a gravy boat. Shush, keep your voice down. My mum will hear. The Great Bartholomew continued hush. This is an ancient mystical lamp. Oh. Passed down through the sands of time, protected by ancient magic. Right, because it looks like a fancy gravy jug, doesn't it? That's my home, by the way. I've not turned up here and the first thing I've said is that your house looks like a massive stupid teapot, have I? It doesn't. But if it did, I wouldn't say that it did because I'm too polite. But you admit your lamp looks more like a gravy boat. Grace rocked back on her heels, her arms folded in a pose that said, Ha ha, I've got you there. It was a pose that Grace used quite a lot. A bit too much, really, if we're being honest. She could be quite annoying. So, have you just been up here in your gravy boat for 40 years? Lamp! It's a lamp! Lamp, whatever. But yes, about 38 years, I think, give or take. The Great Bartholomew said, stretching and arching his back like someone who'd just got out of bed. So how do you fit in the lamp? Is it magic? Yep, magic. Wow, it's amazing. That's nothing. What do you mean? Nothing. It's magic. Well, yeah, but it's not the most impressive magic, is it? I don't know, said Grace. The only magic I've seen was the magician at Maeve's birthday last year. And he wasn't really magic. I could tell he was hiding things up his sleeve. That's not magic. Magic is real. Right, okay. How can you not believe me when I've just appeared in front of you? Out of a gravy boat. Lamp! Ancient lamp! All right, I'm just pulling your leg, said Grace with a smirk.
Leave my leg alone, please,
the great Bartholomew said grumpily.
Anyway, I can prove to you that I am magic,
he said, standing proudly up to his full height, which wasn't very high, but he still looked quite impressive in his fancy flowing clothes. Oh, great. Go on, then.
You have to ask me something. I can't just tell you things.
Can't tell me things? Like what? Asked Grace, a little annoyed.
Well, I can't tell you what sort of things. It's a part of our ancient code. I know. It's all rather silly.
So are you like a genie?
No, I'm not a genie. Well, I sort of am, but I'm not. There are lots of different kinds of genies.
And what kind are you? The grumpy kind? Or can't you tell me that either? The great Bartholomew muttered something under his breath about Grace not being as nice as her dad, which she didn't hear. She thought the muttering was a spell.
Oh, are you doing some magic?
She asked excitedly.
Nope, you have to, you know,
he said, flicking his head towards her a little to emphasize his question.
What do I do? Do I
just wish for something?
That might be an idea.
Right. Well, I would like... A million things whizzed through Grace's head. But she knew how these things worked. She was smart. She'd read about genies in books. Generally, the rules were that you could ask for 3 wishes, but none of those could be for more wishes. So she had to be smart with her wishes. A horse. She could get a horse, but she'd have to have somewhere to keep it. And it wouldn't really fit in the back garden. That would be cruel on it. Grace had loads of other ideas. Bikes, cars, money, snow, making miserable old Mr. Peter's house next door turn into a massive trifle. That would teach him for not throwing her and Shay's ball back the other week. But in the end, Grace did what any right-thinking 10-year-old would. Please can I have a box filled with 1,000 chocolate bars? Her eyes nearly bursting out of her head with excitement and anticipation.
1,000 chocolate bars!
Yes!
Okie dogs from Magical Snogs!
Called the great Bartholomew, as a puff of smoke burst up in front of Grace. And when the smoke subsided, there was a box the size of a washing machine overflowing with every kind of chocolate bar you could imagine. Grace just gasped, clasping her hands to her face and dancing a happy jig. 2 villages away from where Grace lived, there was a little sweet shop. It had been run by the same lovely old couple, Roy and Gwen, for years and years. And even though they were very, very old and they really didn't make a lot of money, they kept their little sweet shop open. You know why? Because they got such immense satisfaction from the huge smiles of the happy children who popped in and picked a bag of their favourite sweets or chocolate bar on their way back from school. And in all the time that they had been running the shop, you know what had never happened? Neither Roy nor Gwen had ever popped out back to grab a jumper because it was getting chilly and returned to the shop mere seconds later to find that every single chocolate bar had simply vanished from the shelves. So imagine how confused and upset Roy was on this Tuesday afternoon when precisely that happened.
There we go. So that was Grace in the loft with the genie. I did enjoy that character as well.
I feel like that character was quite easy. Was that character based on anyone?
No, not really. Why?
Roughly? No? I just thought your daughter might have had a little bit of a
say. You mean the Grace character?
Yeah, sorry, not the... You were talking about the
genie character. And then I'm thinking, what? How is that even...
I see what you're saying now.
No, there probably is a bit of that in there, yeah that kind of forthrightness and bloody-mindedness,
Exactly.
But yeah. I don't know for the... genie characters. Maybe there's a smattering of myself in there.
I think there was.
Maybe. But
Tommy, this whole thing, this whole you writing kids stuff, it's like you've come home. It's like you found your
genre. It's like a hand in a glove.
It does. It fits your sense of humour. It fits your anarchic sensibilities.
I do enjoy the fact that there are bendy boundaries.
Exactly. It's the lack of rules, I think. It's the flexibility, isn't it? To write exactly what amuses you. And I think that's probably when you're at your best.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that, yeah.
You're sort of, because you've got quite a, and I mean this in a very nice way, you've got a very tangential way of thinking.
So you're very juvenile sense of humour, Tom. You have a very immature and juvenile sense of humour.
No, but
you
love a little aside every now and then and things like that.
Oh,
I love that as well. It's like you're fooling around, basically. You're kind of updating known tropes in this particular thing and making them your own.
I always like that. Yeah. I always really enjoy that for some reason. I guess, it's just kind of running with something, then breaking the rules or changing it or turning it on its head.
That's it, yeah.
I always find that fun. I always love like a pastiche or something like that, a parody type thing. You know, when they do like comic relief and they'll have EastEnders does Generation Game or something, or there's like a someone's playing a part, a known non-actor person is playing a part. I love stuff like that for some reason.
It's something you know flipped on its head.
Yeah, kind of thing, isn't it? I tried to get us to write a radio sketch show based around the entire thing, didn't I?
Oh, yeah.
Of Saturday Night TV, of pastiches of things. But yeah, no, I love a pastiche.
I like as well, there's like... I always like this as a reader when you're sat with your child, those little knowing nods to the potential adult reader.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? That's a nice thing as well. When a writer throws you a little adult bone.
Yeah, yeah.
And you feel like you're having a little knowing chuckle with them. And in your one, there's a reference to like a shell, an ornamental shell, which is a reminder for the parents about some adventure that they had on a beach. And it's a nice little nod and wink to the adult reader.
Mm.
It's very nice. It's very nice. You've got a future in this, Tom.
Well, if nothing else, I enjoyed it.
No, I really enjoyed it. I could tell you enjoyed it, and I was feeding off that enjoyment.
Do you know what I think? The other thing is, it's actually a bloody good idea, that one, as well, isn't it?
It is. Although I did think, this is my only... Because I know you said you had this idea a while ago. I was thinking, hang on, there's a thing in the loft that... does really good things for somebody, but there's a payoff. Yeah. And I was thinking,
and
Beast and the Bethany is fundamentally that
idea. I mean, I don't want to have... I'm going to let him have it. I'm not going to sue him.
You're not going to try and sue him?
No, I think it's fine. I don't begrudge him the success. That's fine if he wants to. Difficult to say who came up with what first, but
But yeah, no, it was very good, Tommy. Very good.
Thank you. What have you got for us then?
Well, I know, you know, we were supposed to be doing middle grade children's books.
Yeah.
So I had this idea for a children's book a while ago. But when I started writing it, I realized it wasn't really a middle grade children's book at all. It was actually a young adult book, which is more your teens, isn't it? Basically, post 12. Yeah. So that's kind of who I ended up writing for. And
it's all right.
Yeah, no, it's all good. I mean, I think we did say specifically we'd do middle grade, but, you know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But, I've enjoyed reading a lot of books more that age, probably. I've probably read more of your, you know, Patrick Ness's, John Green, Angie Thomas, Louis Sacker, you know, that sort of thing. So, yeah, that's kind of more where I went.
I thought you were going to go the other way, and after not producing anything... just turn up and go, all right, yeah, no, I wrote a kid's book, but it's younger. It's just a picture book. There's no words. And then try and sort of style it
just
out.
Just explain it.
Yeah. Just go, so there's a picture of a dinosaur, a really good picture of a dinosaur. And then on the next page, there's a really, oh, it's such a good picture. It's lovely illustrations, I imagine, being done. It must be really weird writing a kid's book that's just a little.
Yeah, it's just pictures.
Or just has very light, do you mean it's just like an early reader type thing? So it's just got like one line on each page that happens to rhyme. With the neck, but then it'd be really hard to convince yourself you've finished or you've done enough. Just send that to you if you've got an editor or an agent or something. Hey, I've written this. It's just 8 lines of rhyming things about clothes.
Yeah,
be weird.
You've probably got to use very specific words as well that are, you know, that the curriculum is encouraging children to pick up.
Yeah, on. Ones they can understand. There's no point doing that, even if it's just short sentences. But they're really complicatedly written, complex, really long words and deep, meaningful concepts. It's not gonna fly, is it? It's not gonna fly.
No.
Tommy the Elephant and His Existential Crisis. This looks good one. Good one for the 6-year-olds.
I wonder if teachers mostly write those books. Are they good fun to write? I can't imagine sitting down and going.
You just knock them up. Take 10 minutes, wouldn't it? Kind of thing. You get a phone call going from your publisher going. Yeah, we need a new rhyming story. Oh, yeah, fine.
What do you want it to be about?
5 o'clock now. Get it back by 8 o'clock if you want. Is that all right? Yeah, it'll be fine.
Hey,
be
listen, easy. if you do write those books, send us an email. Tell us about it. We'd be really intrigued to find out how long it does actually take you and how annoyed you are with us now.
2 hours, Tom.
Probably.
Yeah, easy.
It's not a big word count.
It's a drawing that takes all the time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, shall we hear your story?
Yeah, let's do that.
What is it? What is it called, John?
It's called... Kit Starkey Alien Hunter.
I can see the front cover already.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, it's like dark blues when maybe like got some kind of laser sight on it or something with a a young teen child like jumping out the way.
Cool.
Yeah?
Thank you. Kit Starkey, Alien Hunter. Prologue. Aaliyah Starkey's eyes sprang open. Something was wrong. She lifted her head to where a full moon was leaking a channel of mercury through a gap in the curtains, flowing down the bed and pouring over her husband's face, mouth open, oblivious, his deep breathing mocking her quick, shallow breaths. She lay still, listening, feeling uneasy. Everything seemed quiet. Everything seemed okay. Maybe the baby had cried out. Maybe that's what had woken her. She slid her long, dark legs from the covers, wrapped herself in a robe, and padded along the landing to the nursery. The cot glowed in the moonlight spilling through the open door. Leaning over it, she smiled at the curve of her baby's cheek, lit like a lunar crescent. She reached down and stroked his forehead. It was only then she noticed. The standby light on the baby monitor was dark, and no orange light seeped around the edge of the blackout blind. The street light right outside Kit's window was dark. The power was out. Then a sound. Outside, perhaps. The clatter of something falling over and a sharp bark. She frowned, shuffled downstairs. Peering into the kitchen, the dog bed was empty. The LED clock on the oven dark. She stepped into the lounge, to the large patio windows, and looked out into the silvery garden, where, in the middle of the lawn, facing the big rhododendron bush, was their aging black lab, Maisie. The dog was staring at a spot in the hedge, her teeth bared, the fur along her back lifted into a ridge. Aaliyah stared at where the dog's attention was focused, but couldn't see anything unusual. Despite a strange growing dread, she moved to the back door, which alarmingly was slightly ajar. She rolled her eyes at her husband, whose job it was to put the dog out one last time and lock up at night. "That's how you got out," she said under her breath, as she opened the door to call the dog in. But when she looked into the garden, it was empty. "Maisie," she called quietly. "Come on, Maisie, in now." She waited a moment, then whistled, knowing the greedy old girl had never been able to resist a treat. But still she didn't come. Slipping on her gardening shoes, Aaliyah pulled the robe tight around her and stepped out into the cold, eerily still air. She was halfway across the lawn, wishing the outside light still worked, when she heard the hedge rustle. "Come on, girl," she said, heading towards the sound. She reached the bush and crouched, parting two branches to peer into the dingy undergrowth. A large, dark shape in the middle of the bush seemed to shiver. "Maisie," she said again, coaxingly. "What are you doing in there?" Her eyes were beginning to adjust to the gloom, and she could just make out the dog's snout curled around towards her tail. "You okay, girl?" The dog shivered again, a kind of violent spasm that caused Aaliyah's eyes to open wide. The dog was uncurling quickly now, but instead of rolling into a stand, her shoulder joints were tensing, contracting painfully one at a time, making horrible popping noises. The dog's head looked suddenly swollen, its snout shorter. And then Aaliyah saw, protruding from the end of the dog's thin front legs that reached out towards her, not paws, but long, bony fingers.
"Oh, God!"
she screamed and began to run towards the house. Meanwhile, Arthur Starkey had woken to the sound of a scream, found his wife missing from next to him, and was up and rushing to the bedroom door in his T-shirt and boxer shorts before he'd had time to figure out whether it was night or day. A muffled scream from behind him made him spin around and run back to the window. Looking out into the garden, he was just in time to see the woman he loved being dragged through the gate at the back of the house by a tall, thin, stooping figure. Chapter 1. The stars were up there somewhere, but on this particular night, all celestial light was obscured by a thick, metallic layer of cloud. When the rain began in earnest, Kit's dad had hastily tied a tarpaulin over their heads. For a while it offered some relief, but now it was just a very efficient means of funneling icy drips down Kit's neck. He must have made some kind of disgruntled noise without realizing, because his dad seemed to notice him. Even lifted his night vision goggles and whispered, "You okay?" Kit looked back at his dad, feeling cold water pooling in his bum crack and the numbness of his legs, and said, "No, Dad, I don't think I am." The thing is, for most of Kit Starkey's 14 years on Earth, at least for as long as he could remember, he'd held an unshakable belief. A belief so powerful, he'd pictured it in his mind many times over. He would be crouched in their usual spot, scanning the gnarled black shadows of trees with his infrared binoculars, when he would suddenly freeze. There would be movement over there by the edge of the clearing. Zooming in, hands shaking, he would pick out something on the side of a tree trunk, something that wasn't there before. And after a moment of steadying himself, it would come into focus and the realization would hit him that what he was looking at was not a bird or a squirrel, but the impossibly long fingers of a hand. He would tap his dad on the shoulder, point, and then, returning the binoculars to his eyes, he would witness the dome of a hairless, elongated head beginning to emerge from behind the tree. And before they knew it, a group of stooping, freakishly long-limbed bodies glowing green from the optoelectronic imaging would appear, stalking quickly through the woods towards them, huge, cold eyes dead as holes. Yes, he had always believed that one day he would encounter extraterrestrial beings, as incredible but inevitable as one day seeing a shooting star or a kingfisher or a good Adam Sandler film. However, recently he'd realized the belief he'd held on to for so long did not, in fact, belong to him. It never had. It had been his dad's belief all along. It was only really when he joined secondary school that he fully comprehended that nightly outings into the woods to hunt aliens wasn't what most kids did in the evening, a lesson he wished he'd learned earlier. Not even his best friend knew that the reason Kit rarely hung out was because he was traipsing up the hill again with his dad to the clearing in the woods, to the place where his father swears he saw a spacecraft and four aliens that night, 13 years ago to the day, October the 19th, that terrible world-ending night. The truth is, he and his dad's exploits had become a ritual so entrenched he had never even thought to question it. Until now. Because now he was nearly 14, suddenly, inexplicably, the whole thing seemed, well, it just seemed a bit silly. "I think I'm done, Dad. Let's just give it another half hour, eh? You cold? Do you want my hand warmer?" said his dad, flicking the goggles back into position over his eyes. "No, I mean I'm done, like done. "All right," replied his dad impatiently, then said, "Fine, off you go then. I might camp out tonight, seeing as though it's, you know, the anniversary." Kit clicked his head torch onto the very dim setting and stood up. He looked at his father, eyes still scanning the woods, crouched in camo fatigues, beard overgrown, grey hair sprouting out the sides of a baseball cap, and sighed. "Right, well, I'll see you back home then," said Kit. Without moving, his dad said quietly, "You really gonna go? Tonight of all nights? I'm pretty sure aliens don't plan their lives around our calendars, Dad. You think they're going to mark the date with a little celebration visit?" he said, beginning to walk away, still chuntering to himself. Beam back a live feed to the planet Zorg like, "Hey, guys, it's the 29th of October. You know what that means." "Ha ha," said his dad, unamused. "I remember a time you used to enjoy this." Kit stopped, turned back to his dad. "Yeah, do you know what, Dad? You're right, but now..." "Now what?" "I just think it's a bit sad, Dad." His father lifted up the goggles again and turned to his son, frowning. "Sad?" "Yeah. Sat out here practically every night. I mean, come on." "Well, you don't come out nearly as often as you used to." There was an edge of hurt in his voice. "No, Dad, I don't. Don't you think it's time you got another hobby?" "You think this is a hobby?"
"I mean, are you sure about what you saw that night? Couldn't have been, I don't know, something else, like lights or people dressed up. I don't know, nutters."
"Nutters?
I've been reading about post-traumatic stress. It can put your body into proper distress. It makes people remember things wrong. It makes people see things that sometimes..."
"Makes people see things? Are you
His father stopped speaking, was suddenly very nearly too upset to speak. Kit held up his hands. I just think it might be time to... It might be healthier, mentally, to stop this now. Even if you're right, even if it was Little Green Men, I think you should let it go now. Arthur Starkey's jaw was set like concrete. For a moment, he didn't trust himself to speak. Just go home. I'll talk to you later, he managed. Great. I'll look forward to that. But before Kit could finish his sentence, the entire clearing was bleached suddenly with intense white light.
Brilliant, brilliant. Good stuff,
yeah,
John.
Yeah, so that's about as far as I got with that one. I'm not sure I've finished that chapter.
No, it needs a lot
needs
of work.
A bit of end.
Well done for getting hitting the deadline. That's the main thing, isn't it?
So.
Content
I
be damned.
So.
You hit the deadline. Yeah. Well done.
I've written this story, so I know exactly what happens in it. And
really?
I'm actually really pleased with the entirety of the story, which is quite rare for me because normally, you know, I'd start something like this and I wouldn't have a clue where it was going to go. But I spent more time probably...
Right, so you've planned.
Yeah, outlining the story in a lot of depth than I did actually writing the first bit. But there you go. I'm not trying to make excuses. I'm just telling you the truth of the matter.
Well, we've done a task.
We have, yeah.
We said we would. And we have would. So there we go.
Well done, Oz.
Probably time for a little break then, isn't it? And then we'll come back and do some more story reading.
Yeah, let's do that.
Hello again. I was just buffing up the inside of Sammy's shell because it got very dirty. Well, that bit of the podcast was nice, wasn't it? Lovely stuff there. Super stories, I thought. Did you like them? Well, not for everyone, I suppose. Anyway, I probably ought to warn you now. The next bit of the podcast is unsuitable for small ears or even young people with big ears. I mean, regardless of ear size, if you're sensitive to potty words or if the idea of children in peril upsets you, then the next section of the podcast most certainly isn't for you. Your gran will love it, though!
And welcome back. So now we're going to talk about John's miserable failure in... What competition was it that you failed miserably in?
Yeah, so, okay, so this was a short story that I entered into a competition back in January. And I can't really remember why. I think I just fancied having a go because I was in a bit of a...
Good on you.
I was in a bit of a little sticky point, I think, with the murder mystery, and I fancied a little challenge.
Right, yeah.
So this is one of those where you get the genre, you get the theme and the character, right? And you have a few days to write it.
So what did you get?
So my genre, again, was horror.
Why do you always
get horror?
You literally always get horror.
I know.
I don't know if it's the universe trying to tell you something or the universe taking the piss out of you. I don't know which one it is, to be honest. Could be either, couldn't it? But seriously, you do. I suppose the other choices tend to be things like historical fiction and stuff. So you could think yourself lucky in some respects, but... And you do like horror, don't you? You consume it as a...
Yeah, I don't mind it.
Like horror films.
I quite enjoy it, yeah. So it's all right. I didn't really mind. It was just a bit weird that I got it again.
Yeah.
And then the theme...
Right.
...was multiple choice.
Okay.
And the character had to be an underwriter.
So does that have to be a character or the main character? How does that...
I wish I could remember, Tom. I think it's just... Right. I think it has to be a character that features... prominently.
Just needs to be included.
Say. Yeah.
You can't just write a random story and go, and then an underwriter
will. I'm an underwriter, he
and
said.
That's, you can't, that's... And
went on his merry way. Yeah, so a prominent character, but yeah, I don't think it had to be the main character.
So genre, horror, theme, multiple choice, character, an underwriter.
That's it. And the word limit was, I think it was 2,500 words.
Oh, right, it's quite long, quite long.
I think... which I pretty much wrote up to with like 100 words to spare or something. So this is quite long as well. So
it's a nice. This episode is very much a put your feet up, isn't it? And kind of just
it is.
Just have a listen.
Yeah, just enjoy the stories.
Yeah.
So yeah, so this is what I did, and you know what? Just to make it a little bit more difficult for myself,
you didn't use the letter E.
No,
it wasn't one of those.
No, I set it in the US. I set it in South California.
Right.
And there were reasons for that, which will hopefully become more clear. But I also think I was sort of, in the back of my mind, I was thinking, it, maybe this would help with this whole sort of lost in translation thing that you sometimes get with stuff like this.
Right, so this was another American...
It was an American competition. Exactly. So after last week's comment about me voicing a story in another terrible accent, I feel like I should probably make another apology for my not great generic American accent. Sorry, US listeners. But yeah, it would sound a bit weird if I did it in, you know, Yorkshire accent. And also, I suspect you're probably used to Brits doing crap US accents.
Yeah.
Daniel Craig.
All the time. When they do that, when they cast like an entire cast of British actors and then get them all being American, and you think, come on, you didn't need to do
Can't
that.
Can't they just be British?
Yeah, didn't need all that, did they?
I mean, I don't want to single out Daniel Craig in Knives Out, but did he have to be from there?
I couldn't watch it. I actually literally turned it off.
It could have just been too much,
wasn't it?
Anyway, he obviously enjoyed doing it, so we're not going to knock old Craig.
I don't think he... Old Danny. Did he do a bad job with the accent, though? And I'm not sure he did. It's just that it just jarred with everything you knew about his face.
About Daniel. Well, maybe,
it just didn't...
Maybe it didn't fit his face. Maybe you're right.
If it had been an audio thing, I don't think... You know, it would have just been a very strong southern accent, wouldn't it?
Maybe.
Anyway.
Let's be kind and say yes.
Anyway, this is all distracting from people. People just want to hear.
Do they?
Yeah. I mean, they only want to hear it so they can agree with all the judges' comments.
Mock my...
but they still want to hear it, so... Let's read the story, John! Is that the right kind of accent?
It's pretty close.
Good. Yeah. Thank you very much.
The calculation. Old Testament rain is bouncing off the state highway, close to where a vineyard holds back the desert. By the roadside... Lying in the wet shadow of the ribbon woods, there is an untidy bundle of clothes. It is dusk, and the roar of an engine retreating towards the city is absorbed into the relentless tarmac smack of rain and the rhythmless screaming that rends the drowning air.
Hello, Felix. I'm glad you finally picked up.
My coffee cup stops in midair. Something disturbing about the voice on the end of the line. Too low, cold, and hard, like it's coming from deep underground, a voice like permafrost. Here I am, I say, unsure quite how to answer.
We need to talk.
Help if I knew who I was talking to.
Someone who knows you well.
The voice has a slight accent, Hispanic maybe. Well, as you're such a close friend, I'm sure you'll understand I've got to be somewhere, I say with a lightness I don't feel, tipping the last dregs of coffee down my neck.
We need to talk about choices,
grates the voice. I grab my bag, head to the lobby. Choices?
Yes, I'm giving you a choice,
it says.
At least you get a choice.
I laugh, wondering who's pulling this little stunt. But the preternaturally deep growl of the voice unsettles me. Well, that's really good of you. Look, I'd love to stay and shoot
Think of it as a game. A game you know well, being in the insurance business. You place a value on an asset, assess its risk of cessation, and calculate your decision.
This is hilarious and everything, but I've really got to go, I say, still trying to work out who's doing this. Probably that smart-ass Muslim kid in property estimations back in San Diego HQ, Arshad, with some voice-enhancing gizmo. I'm just leaving the Phoenix office, Arshad. Also, Halloween's 3 weeks away, you prick.
Check the link I sent you,
says the voice. Suddenly doesn't sound so much like Arshad. Yeah, right. Like I'm gonna click on some dubious...
Check the link now, or your family will die.
I stop dead, halfway across the lobby. Look, I say through my teeth, whoever the fuck this is, that isn't even remotely funny. Now fuck off. Stop calling, or I'm calling the police.
If you hang up now... Kirsty's carotid artery will open like a sluice gate.
Somewhere in the background, I hear a faint cry. A cold wave of panic percolates along my spine and out into every cell. Who is this?
Like I said, you have to make a choice. Click on the link I emailed you, Felix. You've got 10 minutes.
If you touch Kirsty, I blub, finding myself in the lobby by reception. A young woman behind the desk frowns. My lanyard is hanging over my hand. I'm about to mouth something at the receptionist when the voice speaks quietly into my ear.
Don't even think about the police. Don't think about telling anyone. This is just between us, Felix. You've got 8 minutes now.
I need to stay a little longer, I say to the woman, and lift the ribbon of the passkey back over my head. I've just remembered something. I take the stairs two at a time. Now listen, whatever the fuck it is you're playing at, just don't do anything stupid. If this is about money, I'm sure we can come to some arrangement. It's silent on the line. Nothing. Not even breathing. I throw open the doors to the second floor, breathless, looking for an empty meeting room. Did you fucking hear me? I say a little louder. But the line has gone dead. Some black woman standing in a doorway spins around, gives me a disapproving look.
What?
I bark back. She shakes her head and shuts the door behind her. I step into an empty room, get out my laptop, almost fumble it on the floor, then sit and open it up. There's an email from deadserious110520, subject, time to choose, received 0958. In the body of the email is a Camstream link. I click on it. The screen that appears is made up of 4 live video feeds. As I begin to make sense of what I'm seeing, my heart wants to leave my chest. The chair I'm perched on slides away, and I'm kneeling on the floor before the screen. In the top left, my wife Kirsty is taped to a chair, trying to angle her face away from something on the other side of the picture, what looks like the barrel of a shotgun. On the second screen, my 10-year-old boy Kai is also taped to a chair, his eyes bulging with terror. He's wearing some kind of headgear. Electrodes. Fucking electrodes. Wires running to the mains. On the bottom left, my 12-year-old daughter Trudy is tied to a stool. Her eyes are wet, and she's shaking uncontrollably. The stool is balanced on a plank of wood. At first, I can't make out what I'm seeing. Then I realize there's nothing below her. The plank of wood is bridging our gallery stairwell. Below her is a 2-story drop to the hallway. I force my eyes to the final screen, the one I didn't want to acknowledge. That can't be possible. It's Billy, our 9-month-old baby, still in his cot, lying on his back, oblivious to the glass box alongside him. A hollow, sick feeling is filling my lungs, making it hard to breathe. There's a gleam of movement behind the glass. It's the coil of a snake. I cry out wordlessly. Then I see the timer in the top corner of the screen. 6 minutes, 10 seconds, and counting down unreasonably quickly. Urging myself to stay calm, I scan the 4 video feeds. Before each of them is a red button. You have to choose, the voice said. Assess the value of the asset, calculate the risk, and make a choice. I'm struggling to see the screen through tears, wiping at them ineffectually as they refill again like holes in the beach. My mind races. I could call the police. I visualize them now, an entire squadron speeding towards the house, sirens blaring. Then I imagine whoever is doing this quickly and gleefully slaughtering my entire family. I have no choice but to make a choice. I wipe my eyes again and study each screen. Might any of them survive? Trudy, at best, will be paralyzed for the rest of her life. Kirsty, unlikely to survive. Best case scenario, reconstructive surgery saves some of her face. Kai, maybe? Kai is tough for a kid, but I can't choose Kai. I don't know how long the shock will last, what voltage. But that only leaves Billy. I look closely at the screen. Maybe the snake is harmless. I lean forward, try and make out a pattern on the side of the snake. Dark triangles. Could be a rattler, but I don't know much about snakes. Don't boas also have dark markings like that? Can't believe I'm seriously considering putting my baby in harm's way, but now I'm thinking, without wanting to, that he's the newest member of the family. I think of the redundancies made at the firm last year. Last in, first out. That's what they said was the fairest way. Is that how I should look at this? But surely Billy has the best chance of survival, too. They say venomous snakes rarely attack unless they feel threatened. Would it feel threatened by a baby?
I get out my phone and Google images of snakes that crush their prey. Definitely not a python, but one picture of a boa looks very similar. What then? Fuck. Should I risk it? My finger slides the cursor towards Billy. It's shaking. My nervous system is fizzing with a cocktail of homemade stimulants. My brain attempting to calculate risk, to figure out why this is happening to me. Then I remember something. Wipers sweeping sheets of rain, streaking lines across the windshield. I'm squinting through the dark, squeezing the throttle out of each bend. It's been a long day. Conference in Arizona. I want to be home. First roadworks on the interstate. Now as I snake quickly along the Mexican border. Fucking monsoon on the 94. I squint. Something right ahead. A dark patch against the road, a shadow, an animal. I brake, too hard, too late. The car begins to slide. I'm fucking sideways, foot still on the brake, screaming, the car sliding. And then a thud and a crack, loud. Glass splinters into the car. Stillness. Quiet. Just the swish of wipers. The hammering of rain. I get out, legs unsteady. My side of the car is untouched, pristine. I walk to the rear. All fine. Circling, I see the passenger side, the deep crater in the door. Goodbye, excess. Then I hear a long, loud wail, turning towards the sound, startled. Further back along the highway, lit in red, a woman is screaming. She's Hispanic-looking, wearing a backpack and carrying a plastic shopping bag in each hand. Her belly protrudes from under a soaking t-shirt. She's not wearing a coat. I walk towards her, blood draining out of me, feeling rainwater run down my face into my eyes. I swallow, dry-throated. She's standing over a lifeless confusion of clothes by the side of the road. She looks up at me. She won't stop screaming. I suddenly understand. Fuck. Oh, God. Fuck, fuck, fuck. I look back at the red glare of the car's lights, then run. A vibration in my pocket makes me start. I drag my phone from it. Why are you doing this? I beg.
You haven't worked it out.
Who are you?
You need to make your choice, Felix. I can see you're logged on. Who's it going to be?
You can't put a value on someone's life like that, I say, snot running over my top lip.
Really? We both know that's not true. In your world, some people are simply worth more than others. It's a fact. It might not be nice, but it doesn't make it less of a fact. A law, if not of nature, then of economics.
No, people are not assets. You don't grade people like that. That's not how it works.
So you think a white man who works in insurance, who earns a six-figure salary, is worth exactly the same as, say, a Venezuelan immigrant? In terms of their value to society, their human rights, their entitlement to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?
I swallow, knowing better than to answer that question. Look, whatever it is you think I've done, whatever this is about, let's talk about it sensibly.
You don't remember?
I stare at the screen. My daughter is crying. My wife staring imploringly at someone behind the camera. The timer is on 48 seconds. Remember what? What am I supposed to remember? I bawl.
I made a vow,
says the cavernous voice,
that I would find you, and I would study you, and I would make sure that you understood the burden of my suffering for the last 12 years. So make the choice, or I will make a worse one for you.
Salt sweat drips into my eyes. I blink, realizing my whole body is damp. I hear myself sob. The cursor hovers over Billy, touches his perfect face, the round of his cheek. 9 seconds. And then, with a sound that begins small in my chest and opens up into a howl like the sound that night by the side of the county highway, I click the button below my baby boy. What now? Talk to me, please. Don't hurt Billy. I am begging you. I'm sorry if I hurt you. If I did something, if I made a mistake. It was 12 years ago. But the phone has gone silent again. I slump forward, sobbing, my hands on the floor, my forehead on the desk, chest heaving. The door to the meeting room opens behind me. I spin around and hold up my hand. This room's occupied! I turn back to the laptop, praying the video feed is back online, but the screen is still blank. Mistake? Says a voice behind me. I spin around to see a foreign-looking woman by the door and yell, I said this room is fucking occupied! The woman narrows her eyes slightly. I frown, take in the face, the eyes that slope down at the edges, the dark skin, the face. I know it, though it's void of emotion now. You, I say quietly, beginning to stand. Yes, she replies, calmly producing a small handgun from her purse, clicking the door shut behind her. My family. Billy. They're all fine. I filmed them yesterday evening. I left them tied to the bed 6 hours ago. They'll get over it. You fucking... Felix, don't make a scene. Don't make a scene? You abduct my family? You psychologically torture them? Then you come here! Felix, she says calmly as though soothing a child. It's over now. What do you mean, over now? She steps closer to me. Don't come any closer! I'll fucking scream! People will be here in seconds if I scream! Let them come, she whispers. Why are you here? Why am I here? Why do you think? Haven't you had your fun? You think this was about me having fun? You wanted to teach me a lesson or something, but I don't know what fucking lesson you're trying to teach me! I think you do, she says, indicating with the gun that she wants me on the floor. Kneel. No, look, kneel. She repeats. There is an edge to her voice now. Please. I beg. The tears are streaming down my cheeks, plopping like raindrops onto the carpet. Just think, she says, the corners of her mouth beginning to rise, the gun with them. Just think. At least you've got life insurance.
So there you go.
I actually enjoyed that story. I think it was a good...
Thanks, man.
It certainly
That's good.
Nailed the multiple choice thing, didn't it? That's... In its most literal sense.
Yeah, I went very literal with that.
Yeah, you had that as like the construct of the story, not just a...
I thought they might like that, you know what I mean? Really,
yeah,
really pluck that out.
The trouble is, when you do these ones, you do that, and you think, and then you think, oh, but then they're just going to go, well, that's obvious. Why has he just chosen the obvious route? Should have been something clever and subtle, but then subtle. We've done What's clever and subtle place? Before, and it hasn't always gone down that well with the Americans, it has to be said.
So, yeah.
I think I speak for everyone, John. When I say, what did the judges say?
Well, in these things, as you'll know, Tommy, they always start with the good stuff.
All right, they found some good stuff.
So let's start there.
Right, yeah.
What the judges liked about your story.
Yeah. Oh, I should probably be trying to guess some of this, shouldn't I?
I think you should, yeah.
I can't. I'll jump in when it comes to the bad stuff. what the judges liked, I would say I liked... The sort of the dialogue-driven nature of it. I don't know what they'd say about that, but I guess the characterization, I felt that was very clear in the dialogue. Did they say anything about that?
I don't think so.
Okay.
But thanks, Tom. That's nice.
No, just, I thought it was...
That just adds to the...
defined characters.
What the judges and Tom liked about my story.
Yeah, there you go. The list gets longer, doesn't it?
It does. It's looking up. Things are looking up.
Yeah.
Do you want to mention anything else, Tom, that you liked about it?
That's
you scraped the barrel.
Yeah, that was
pretty much
Hail
it.
Mary as it was, yeah. What are the judges like?
The kind of dilemma this story presents is perfect for getting the reader to start wondering what they do themselves in the same situation. You've built a tense, ticking clock thriller.
Yeah.
They noticed. They noticed I hadn't really written a horror.
Sorry, I didn't pick up on that. Yeah,
but at the same.
Well, I don't.
But the same.
Come on, there's blurred lines there, and.
Well,
and,
I think so. It was close, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think as soon as you start in threatening violence on a newborn baby, there's...
Yeah, that's horror, isn't it?
Come on.
Okay, good. That was the first thing I read. Obviously, it being at the top, but I did think when I sent it in, that's not really a horror, is it? That's a thriller.
I like that one of their positives is actually kind of a backhanded
really
criticism
great thriller.
Of your choice of genre, your ability to write to a genre.
Yeah, I feel like they hadn't actually checked what genre they'd given me when they wrote that line. Anyway, you've built a tense ticking clock thriller and still found time for a twist at the end. Oh, here you go. Yeah, sorry, I forgot this bit. The dialogue is snappy.
Hey, hello.
There you go.
and the creative death traps intriguing.
Yeah.
I also appreciated the way the assigned elements, underwriter and multiple choice, were so seamlessly integrated with each other.
So they do like it up front and central. Yeah.
So that was a positive for them. Such a good description. Old Testament rain. It's a great opening and makes us want to keep reading. This story also unfolds well. We're surprised by each new twist and turn. This is all sounding pretty good to me.
It is good, yeah.
A grim and suspenseful puzzle of a plot that keeps the reader guessing and holding their breath. The structure of the story takes the reader along for the ride. You cleverly stage this in the first-person voice and set it in the present tense. Didn't really realise I'd done that, but yeah, they're right. So it feels like it's unfolding in real time, horribly and urgently. The taut pacing creates real anxiety, and although the game is implausible... Okay, fair enough. Each family member teetering above their death on a live stream as the timer counts down, it does force the reader to go through the same ordeal as Felix and ask themselves, who would they choose and why? What does this say about me and how I value the lives of others? A clever and well-constructed horror story. I love the moment when the woman enters the room and he still sees only a foreign-looking woman and screams at her. She is invisible to him, and he dismisses her on instinct, a scathing critique of this character's blind spots, demonstrating his deepest metric of human value. Even after this lesson, it can't be unlearned.
I think that's quite good. They read and understood.
They got
the subtext and the... Yeah.
They got the gist.
Yeah.
I mean, I read that and thought, how come you kicked me out of the competition?
Yeah.
You know, I was flying high. And then there's the section that goes...
And there's the long section, yeah.
What the judges feel needs work. It's a nice way of putting it.
It is actually that, isn't it? It's very gentle, that, isn't it?
I think the element to look at for revisions is mostly the physical descriptions. I was never quite sure what the Phoenix office looked like, for instance, and the impersonal backdrop felt more like a hotel. I'm just taking that in. I mean, I know I'm not strong on descriptions. I'm not that bothered about them, really. I tend to want to figure stuff out.
I would agree with them on that, I think. But then I would then ask, but doesn't affect the story.
Did you care what the Phoenix office looked like? Were you stumbling around in the dark?
It didn't even occur to me.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Like, you just imagine an office, don't you?
Yeah.
And a reception area.
And I get what they're saying about the hotel-y thing, but I think that's part of just that kind of relatively clean, clinical, boring, sort of big build office, which could also be a generic mid-price hotel. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like the same. Yeah.
I mean, they look quite similar sometimes, don't they?
Yeah.
But yeah.
But
I mean,
yeah. All right.
I know that some people do like more description than I do, and that's fair enough. Anyway, I'm not going to dwell on that too much. I think that it did sound like that was a little
dwelling
thing.
A little bit, but yeah.
And then they go on to say, when we first see Kirsty, we only see her tied to a chair.
Yeah.
But when Trudy's up next, it's clear the situation is taking place at home. In that case, you could afford to ground the setting immediately. Which, I think that's fair enough. I think, though, if you were looking at little... video screens on, you wouldn't necessarily be able to ground it immediately, would you? You'd be like, what am I looking at? I'm not quite sure what I'm seeing, which is sort of what I was going for.
Well, a part of that sort of slower reveal as well is building the horror, isn't it?
Yeah.
In the way you've done it. Do you mean like, so it's not like, oh, I know everything all at once.
Yeah.
It's kind of, oh God, that's even worse. This was bad. And now it's slightly worse than it was.
Can I arrogantly dismiss that bit then?
Yeah, go on.
Thanks, man.
I want you to do it out loud though. Now.
I arrogantly dismiss you.
Yeah.
Judge 1609.
Well, don't name them, John. That's not... Come on,
it's too
mate.
Late.
That's,
it's too late. Name and shame. That's what I say. Oh. Name and shame. they carry on anyway. They go on to say, in the crash sequence, the mention of squeezing the throttle made me picture a motorbike at first. I think that's probably fair enough as well. That does actually make sense. So I could have been a bit clearer there. Although it obviously is clearer after that they're in a car. But yeah, you don't want to put a picture in someone's head and then take it away from them.
Yeah.
That probably is a good point. None of these are major points, but fixing them will help the reader stay immersed. Okay, different judge now. Could the panic be amped up a bit when he's watching the video? The flashback in the middle is also quite long, so perhaps it could be broken up a bit.
I think that's actually good. I think that's actually good criticism, that.
So
now they've said it.
Yeah. So put a bit more of the flashback in another place.
Yeah. Just tighten the flashback up a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't feel that. Like,
it didn't jump out at me, but once someone says anything, oh yeah, actually, yeah. It's not an entirely misplaced criticism.
I think, to be fair, I think most things could probably be tightened up a little bit. So.
Yeah, and how would you ramp up the panic, do you think? Because you've got his entire family teetering on the brink of death. Maybe they've got twin babies?
Yeah, there's not enough. Maybe that's it. There's not enough babies being threatened.
Yeah. Or maybe one of them could get killed, but it's like a fake. She's faked it.
Maybe
that's about the pacing of it all the way through. That it kind of stays at a similar-ish pace all the way through. It doesn't feel to kind of get that sort of faster.
It does change though, doesn't it? Because he actually has to make a choice in the end, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So it feels like that pushes it on a bit. But to get more panic, yeah. Don't know. Maybe it is just to speed it up.
And you've got the timer. You've got the timer thing, and the other one mentioned the ticking clock, pressure, panic kind of thing. Yeah, don't know. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Just let it go, John. Just let it go.
I can't let it go.
What? Is there anything else?
Yeah. There's more. The flashback to the hit and run.
Yeah.
Is the emotional core of the story.
Yeah.
So interestingly, this is. Does this contradict? I'm not sure. This might contradict the other bit. The images flash by in a rush, as shocking and blurry to the reader as they are to Felix. How does he feel when he realizes he's struck and likely killed a child? Explore briefly this panic. Is it another test? What comes to his mind when he realizes he might lose everything? Does he think of his own family? Is he just concerned about himself, panicked at the idea of going to prison for manslaughter? Does he begin calculating how to cover this, pretend it never happened, the odds of getting away with it if he just leaves? Where do his panicked thoughts take him first? This is another great test, under pressure and pushed to an extreme. So this person wants more in the flashback. They want more of what he's feeling.
Mm.
And they're pretty adamant, because that's a long paragraph. That's the longest paragraph of the thing. That's obviously what they're hankering for. What do you think of that, Tom?
Well,
I feel like that's inferred.
I was just going to say, again, I think this might fall in the category of joining the dots and completing the circle versus not.
I wouldn't want to go into, in that section, I wouldn't want to go into sort of an explanation of feelings. I mean,
are they talking about his reaction after the audience has heard the flashback? So when he's coming to the realization in sort of the final scene of the story in the present time?
I don't know. Well, they're talking about the flashbacks.
That he should then have some massive reflection of guilt or remorse But then part of the point of it is his lack of remorse, isn't it? And just his complete... Yeah. He's bothered about him and his little bubble.
I mean, that is the whole point, really.
And even when the woman comes in, do you mean he's just all about, me. And values of different people because of their, where they come from, or their skin colour, or their situation. It's kind of the core. Yeah, I think there's a balance there of spelling it out.
Yeah. I would agree. I'm thinking about it now. I'm a being unfair. But I don't think he needs to go into that. Because he is wondering who of his... I think that, in some ways, that's more powerful. Him wondering which of his family he should click the button on says a lot more about him than, in a way, worrying about what's going to happen to him in that moment.
And the way he kind of coldly assesses it as per his occupation...
Yeah.
...again echoes his ability to put in a box what happened previously. Mm.
And
shut the box.
Yeah, and I wanted those flashback bits to be shorter and for you not to be able to see in his mind, because those bits are like separate narration. They're narrated from like an omniscient sort of perspective. And I quite like that, because I think then when he just hot foots it to the car and drives away, That tells you everything you need to know, in a way.
And that's him panicking as well.
Yeah.
And we see that he doesn't really, like, he gets, but he's even when he's panicking, he's quite calm at the same time, if that makes sense.
Well, he's very rational. Upset about what
he's
done.
He's very rational, though, isn't he?
Yeah. He's really upset, obviously, about what he's done and when he realises what he's done, as you would be, but he doesn't want to take any responsibility for it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Just wants to get the hell out of there.
Which is what you should be drawing your conclusions from reading it rather than having it spelled out again. I think there's an element, isn't there?
I think so.
Well, and we talked about that before. It's a writing preference. It's a reader preference. It's a judge's preference. People fall on different sides of the fence.
But some people are just wrong.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, in some circumstances, people just get it wrong. Well,
there's one last line, Tom, that I want to read you.
Oh, right, there's more.
Yeah.
Right.
This is a very short bit, and I actually think this is probably really fair.
Oh, right, okay.
It says, "The last line was a little campy and lands like a grim joke. Just think, at least you've got life insurance."
Yeah.
Which I accept that. It was deliberately meant as a grim joke. It's her grim joke, in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, it's again this separation between what the writer has done and what the character has said.
Exactly.
Isn't it?
Exactly. So whilst I think it's fair, I also think in that situation, I don't know, like a grim little joke would be exactly what you'd want to do.
Yeah. Of course, you know, in real life, you'd do that, but you'd get it slightly wrong. And then you'd have to explain it out. Yeah, you have to awkwardly explain it out before shooting them.
You know, because you're in insurance. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's not actually that kind of insurance, so it doesn't really... Right. It's tricky with ones like that, because I guess it's that thing with a short story, you want to kind of put a little full stop on it and a little a punchline, almost. And I think that's quite a nice way of doing it, getting the character to deliver the punchline.
Well, I thought so, but...
But I can see, that's a personal... I can see why someone would read that and think, that's a bit cheesy, isn't it?
Yeah. But how do you end it? I mean, you've got to end it on theme, haven't you? Do you know what I mean? Do you just end it? It feels like it needs a... It's horror. It's sort of... it is a bit campy horror. Listen to me trying to justify myself. Yeah, anyway. I take that. I do take that. And I thought it when I wrote it, but then at the same time I thought, that's actually quite a nice little ending as well.
Those are the difficult choices you need to make, though, aren't they, as a writer? Do you mean you always kind
it's
of...
True.
You can only
it's true.
Judge it by your own judgment.
Yeah.
For want of a much better phrase.
So there you go. I hope you enjoyed everybody.
Well done for entering
I hope you enjoyed me squirm.
Yeah, absolutely.
And try and justify myself. It's always fun to hear.
Right, well, that's enough of critiquing some writing. Join us after this very short break where we'll be critiquing some writing.
Quick, under the table. And I think that just about wraps up this week's episode. Thanks so much for joining us. See you next time. What? Oh, God, there's more. Apparently there's more. So that's nice. Here's part 3 of the Failing Writers Podcast.
By now, you do understand how this works. We take one of your whips, one of our listeners' whips, work in progress, and we turn a little bit of it into some beautiful audio poetry, and then we discuss it. So should we have a little listen to this week's?
Yeah, so this one was sent in by James Felix. And interestingly, this one. So this is book 4 in an unpublished series featuring the character Nelson, who's a bit of a sort of a spy.
He's an agent, isn't he?
Yeah, maybe a little bit Jason Bourne, that kind of thing.
In fact, he describes it, doesn't he, as a kind of a British Jack Reacher.
Yeah, yeah. What I find slightly fascinating about this is when James emailed it in, he said, so he sent us chapter 2, 3, and 4. And you think, well, where's chapter 1? Surely chapter 1 comes first.
It's a mystery.
There is no chapter 1 yet, because I planned on going back and writing that when I have a better feel for how the story develops. I find that fascinating.
Yeah.
To leave the inciting incident bit till later.
See, I think that's a really good idea.
It's just, I think it's fascinating how different writers' brains work. Don't you think how to go at something is you think, yeah, that's the way you should do it. And someone else look at it and go, what? That's crazy. And it goes, and we think about all the different people we've had as guests on the podcast over the years. And they are, there's all these different, you know, some people literally destroy the first draft of their...
Yeah, it's like their way of just learning about the character and finding out how they respond
to
each
other. Other people will plan it to an to an nth degree. Mm. Some people will kind of pants it a bit and have some sort of plan. Bloody James is leaving chapter one.
To the end.
So he doesn't, but he doesn't know what the inciting incident is. He must have a rough idea of something.
Do you know what, though? I think that's a book. I think that's a four books thing. I think he's been here before, hasn't he? And he's always gone back and had to change that bloody first
chapter. I've had to change that anyway. Yeah, yeah, I've written that as that's
what's
happening.
So why faff about for ages trying to write something that might, you know, it might just come easily later
on? So at the moment, chapter one reads, in its entirety, a Masonic murder? Which is brilliant. It kind of sets out something's going to, something's happened.
Does everything it needs.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, his elevator pitch, his little synopsis. Delve into the shadows with Nelson as he unravels the enigmatic web of Chapter 8 and confronts the sinister Mr. Hector, where secrets span decades and trust could cost him everything. In a city of secrets, who can you trust?
Let's hear it, Tom.
Here we go. Insurgent by James Felix. Chapter 2. Saturday. Nelson lifted the cup to his mouth and savoured his reward. A 6-mile run at his usual fast tempo had left him with a good sweat and a satisfying burn in his muscles, but he relished the chance to relax in his favourite cafe and watch the world pass by the wide picture window.
There you go, love,
Ruby said, setting down a round china plate with a Danish in the centre.
Looks like you've earned it. Now what will your handsome friend be having?
David Mad Dog Jones swiveled his wide head towards the cafe owner. The creases on his face deepened along with his broad smile.
I'll have a green tea, please.
No cake. My Victoria sponge is the best in town.
Mad Dog patted his stomach.
Just the tea, miss.
Ruby flashed a white smile, cinched her apron string a little tighter and turned on a heel, before sashaying back through the cramped little coffee house. Nelson sipped his beverage, the corner of his mouth turned upwards.
What?
Growled Mad Dog. Nelson set his cup down and took a large bite out of his pastry without replying.
I'm 57 in a few weeks. I need to watch my cholesterol.
Mad Dog shrugged off his tweed jacket and loosened his tie. I just never pegged you for a green tea type of guy.
You're stuffing a bloody custard and apricot Danish in your face and sipping a flat white.
Nelson choked back a snigger. I guess we've both evolved. The Mad Dog's bulk leaned back into his wooden chair until it squeaked.
Evolve or die.
Not as catchy as Who Dares Wins. Mad Dog paused as Ruby returned with a steaming copper teapot balanced on a tray. She placed the pot on the table in front of the retired colonel and arranged his own cup and saucer to the side. She leaned forward until a blouse billowed open and whispered conspiratorially into his ear.
We just made a delicious batch of chocolate brownies. They're still warm.
Her Bristolian accent burring softly on the word warm. Mad Dog's thick fingers drummed the table surface. He cleared his throat and shot a look at Nelson.
Maybe just one slice, my dear.
Ruby winked at Nelson and about turned towards the glass counter. Nelson drained his coffee. She's a terrific saleswoman. That's why I need to get a run in before I come here. Mad Dog shook his head.
I am a sucker for a brownie.
Nelson gazed through the picture window at the sun-dappled market square of Cirencester. The narrow streets lined with ancient sandstone buildings had become his home in the past month, and the rolling green hills of the Cotswolds his backyard.
Your message sounded urgent, he murmured,
the clatter of plates and the hubbub of conversation easily drowning his voice.
It is,
replied Mad Dog Jones, accepting a generous slice of chocolate brownie from a beaming Ruby, then pausing until she filtered away before cleaving away a chunky corner with his fork.
What do you know about the Freemasons?
Nelson protruded his bottom lip. He knew little. Funny handshakes, aprons and rolled up trouser legs. Mad Dog gobbled down the corner of brownie and immediately set about carving himself a second piece of the slab.
That's the public face. They raise a lot of money for charity and it's a place where middle-aged men gather to drink and network.
No women allowed.
It's an ancient order. It goes back centuries and the rules forbid it. Most Freemasons are law-abiding citizens who advocate more openness within their organisation. You can apply to join these days. It's much less of an exclusive club.
Sounds like you know a fair bit. I'm a member. Nelson's eyes narrowed. Mad Dog had demolished his brownie and, unusually for him, was taking his time getting to the point.
I've been since I retired. The lodge I'm part of is all ex-military. It's a drinking club mainly.
Mad Dog set his fork down on his empty plate and poured himself a cup of green tea.
For years, the Freemasons have been slowly becoming irrelevant. Less young people are interested in joining, and the rule about women excludes half the population. Membership is dwindling and lodges are closing.
I can't say it's ever appealed to me.
You have to wear a tie to get in. You'd fail at the first hurdle.
So what's the interest in a dying institution?
The group has infiltrated the upper echelons and is exploiting the secrecy rules. They've gained access to government, the police, and the military. But these days, the press aren't interested in Freemasonry, so this group is operating with growing impunity.
All sounds a bit like a Dan Brown novel, if you ask me. Mad Dog's brow creased and his jaw clenched.
That's exactly what they're relying on. Most people don't care about a bunch of old men in aprons meeting to drink scotch and smoke cigars. Even the calls for women to be allowed to join have died down. Society's moved on and the Freemasons are being forgotten. But the network still exists. The rules of secrecy bind members, and that is being exploited by this group.
Hiding in plain sight.
Exactly.
What's this shadow group called?
I've only heard whispers, but the name Chapter 8 keeps coming up.
Doesn't give me a lot to go on.
No, but a security company has recently won several government contracts, and the board is dominated by Freemasons.
What's the name of this company?
CH8. I want you to infiltrate them. The top man is a chap called Hector, but any background checks I've attempted have all drawn blanks. They do, however, have plenty of ex-military types on the payroll, including someone we both know.
Nelson smiled. Mad Dog wouldn't have trekked all the way out to the Cotswolds without a plan up his sleeve.
Do you remember Bill Kelly? The association paid for some HGV training for him, and he came to us for a reference for a new job.
With CH8. I do. Tough son of a bitch. Terrible shame what happened. He was never the same afterwards.
Now, happens to a lot of the men. Which is why the Veterans Association keeps tabs on as many as we can.
Give me his number and I'll reach out to him. Be good to see him again. Mad Dog lowered his voice and leaned closer.
He's not the same man anymore, Nelson. Don't expect too much of him, okay?
So we go, that was Nelson and Mad Dog and Rosie in a cafe. Talking about CH8. When the elevator pitch we read just before, the enigmatic web of Chapter 8, and I was thinking, oh, what's happening in Chapter 8?
I had the same
He's only
thought.
Sent us Chapter 3, 2, 3, and 4. And then I went, oh, hold on a minute, you idiot.
Something really kicks off in Chapter 8.
No, you're idiot. That's actually what they call it. Yeah, sorry.
So what do you think, Tom?
I haven't obviously read his previous books, of which there are three others, but it does feel like there's a solid history there between, certainly between Nelson and Mad Dog and kind of the little world in there, doesn't it? It was quite nice.
Yeah, it feels well established. That,
yeah, but it?
It
was one of the, I thought it was done quite well that I didn't feel like, oh, well, I can't follow this. I can't get what's going on here because I don't know them from, you know, they've had all this other, I've not read the other books.
Yeah.
It spelled out quite well who they were and what they were without getting too, you know, sort of cheesy or
Exposition-y.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of just let them be who they are and the, I think it's something nice, isn't there, about this kind of genre, this sort of spy action...
Thrillery.
Conspiracy thriller genre, is that your characters can be... They can be less rounded. They can fit in a nice, relatively neat box. They kind of need to for the sake of how these stories work. And there's something quite nice about that, isn't there? You don't feel there's any... You can go, all right, yeah, I understand what kind of person they are. Oh, right, yeah, I think we've established what kind of person they are.
Yeah.
I quite like that.
You know when you're reading something and you're supposed to be reading it critically and then you sort of forget because it's kind of exactly...
It breezes you along.
Yeah, it's exactly the kind of story that isn't inviting that kind of scrutiny. Do you know what I mean? It's just, like you say, it's just moving forward at a lick and you like the characters and it's intriguing, so you want to know what happens next. It's that.
But it's an easy read. It's a holiday book,
it's great.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Nice and easy to pick up. It's not like, oh, God, right, this is going to be a a trudge. It's just like story, 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 action, action.
Yeah, exactly.
And like I said, keeping, not trying to be too smart or twisting, you know, it'll still have its twists and turns, but it's taking you with it rather than kind of like trying to jolt you all over the place.
It's like you, it's not a genre that I'm, you know, massively familiar with, but more, not with novel form anyway, more with like watching films and things. But it all feels right, doesn't it? Do you know what I mean? It's like the setup feels feels very kosher. It's got a nice flow, and there's a bit of set, like you were saying before about the characters and the way they interact. There's a bit of kind of save the cat-ness about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Likeable banter between two guys and the coffeehouse lady.
And some neat little subtext as well, like the line where it says "evolve or die," and Nelson says "not as catchy as Who Dares Wins." And you think, oh, that's just great, isn't it? Because that shows a little bit of banter between them, but it also shows that there's, you know,
a bit of their history.
Yeah, yeah, they've been in the SAS. So they, do you mean it kind of, but it's just nice, isn't it? It spells it out without going, hey, remember that time in the SAS? It's just nice. It's neat.
It is. And it's got all your bits. It's got secret societies. It's got rich, shady businessmen. It's got a friendly female hacker, techie person.
Yeah, and I think it must be quite liberating writing stuff like this as well, because I think with sort of more worthy novels, if you know what I mean. And that's not a slight at this, just that kind of, you have to maybe sort of veer away from stereotypes and kind of, but there's a comfortable place in this, isn't it? Where, because you've got a conspiracy involving the Masons, no one's going to go, oh God, that's been done before. There's still a hunger and a want for it. It kind of,
because
it's fine. It's good.
It's fascinating.
It's good.
Exactly.
Yeah. There's something liberating about writing it, that you're not constantly looking over your shoulder going, oh, is this...
I've got to really rethink this.
Is this a bit cliche? Or do I have to completely reinvent the genre? It's like, no, don't, because no one will want to read it if you do.
Yeah, I remember
It's got to have these touches. It's like when we're talking... well, we've spoken to a few people, haven't we, that I think Stuart Turton said it. I'm not sure if Mark Billingham said it as well. And people previously, that you can't just throw everything out and try and do something completely original. You do have to touch on these tropes and well, cliches, want a better.
Yeah, but people are expecting
not a bad thing.
Them.
They need to be there.
Yeah, if you don't put them in there, people will be pissed off.
But I think there's a balance, isn't there? And I think, James's writing just ticks along quite nicely.
No, I enjoyed it. I was just totally into it. I wasn't thinking about anything else.
Do you know, the only thing that struck me was the chapters as they are felt very short. Maybe that's just
Don't they tend to be for this sort
quite
of
quite possibly book? I just maybe it's because I wanted to read more. I just felt a bit shortchanged, I think, if anything. Do you mean they kind of wanted more?
You just wanted a couple more chapters in there.
Yeah. I want to know what happens in chapter 8. Something big happens in chapter 8. I'm certain of it.
If you could just send us that chapter.
Just
James,
chapter 8, mate.
Great.
Yeah. I'm not bothered about the rest. Just want to know what happens in chapter 8. I mean, I know what happens in chapter 1. It's a Masonic murder. I don't need to know anything else about that, James. You've covered that very well.
Everything we need to know about that chapter.
But I think, like I said, I think one of the most fascinating things about this was just the chapter 1. I haven't written it yet. Going back to write the inciting incident once I know what it is. I just thought that was so refreshing. I love that.
You got the very strong feeling with this that it isn't James Felix's first rodeo, I thought.
No.
It reads that way. It feels like he's earned his stripes a little bit. You know, he knows what he's doing. Very good. There's nothing really at this stage to fault it. Do you know what I mean?
Not really.
This kind of stuff, it's all about, like, the rest of the book, you know, it's about maintaining the pace and maintaining the intrigue and the tension right up to the last minute. And then, obviously, finding a really nice way to resolve it very satisfyingly.
Yeah.
But we don't know whether he does that or not, because we haven't got the rest of it.
Chapter 8, have we?
And he might not have even written it.
What it did make me think about...
That's good, man. It's good.
...with stuff like this was just how fine the line is between getting published and being a published author and having a series of books like Jack Reacher or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Versus not... Do you mean there's not... There doesn't have to be a massive gap between anything, or...
No.
It's just a... I don't know.
Just being a known
the
author.
More we do this, the more depressing it gets, to be honest, with these
whips.
No, I think
you're right.
There's just...
The margins are tiny, aren't they? Really?
Yeah. So sad times. Sad times.
But also nice, you know, nice.
It's lovely reading this stuff and just and seeing people's different takes on how to write and not write in chapter one or how they deal with it or... Yeah, it's just fascinating, isn't it? Seeing stuff in its kind of raw form. But no, thank
like
you so much.
Passion projects, aren't they?
Yeah,
all these
yeah.
things, you know, nobody's getting paid for any of this stuff.
Yeah.
They're just doing it.
Yeah, no, it's great.
Good on you.
Thank you for sending in, James. Much appreciated.
Yeah. And if you have a work in progress, listener, that you're, you know, working on, maybe haven't finished even a first draft, but you think, oh, that'll be interesting to hear what the chaps have to say
yeah.
about that, then you're wrong. It won't be interesting. But
no.
send it anyway, because no. It'd be really nice.
It's quite nice that they get it read and made up in a little audio thing,
yeah.
isn't that? That's got to be something. They can just yeah. ignore what we say about it, can't they? They can just
exactly.
go, oh, that's nice. It's people on the podcast have heard it. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. It gets your name out there.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
For when you do, you know.
It's amazing, actually, how many times on
level.
Like Twitter afterwards, different listeners be like, oh, I wish I could hear more of that. And it shows there is a quality and a hunger for this stuff there, isn't it?
It means there are lots of people out there writing good stuff and nobody's reading it and seeing
yeah,
it yet.
Yeah.
Mind you, these are all works in progress, so that's partly why, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, that concludes today's story reading bonanza. Marathon.
That was. How do you feel after that, Tom?
It's all been a blur. If I'm honest, but the stories are all merging into one now, so it's a bit weird.
Yeah,
I've got some SAS yeah. guys sat in a cafe with a genie lamp that's
some aliens.
Aliens are coming out of, and they are torturing their entire family. So I think maybe yeah, I just need a bit of decompression time to separate those out again, because that's going to be one hell of a dream tonight. I'll tell you that much.
So. Let's quit while we're ahead. You got any more stories, Tom? You want to do one last story?
Not at the minute, John. No. I'm all spent.
Okay. Hey, speaking of stories, I've got to tell you this. I read a story last week. Guess what story I read last week? Mark Robinson.
Oh, yeah.
Kindly sent us the rest of his novella, You Don't Have to Do This. You know,
yeah.
that short thriller that Dave read the
yeah.
excerpt from. With the writer breaking into the house of the famous author. Well, bloody hell. Did you read it, Tom?
I didn't see it. I didn't know we had it.
Oh, no, he sent it to us. Well, that... Wow. It turned out to be a proper story of two halves. I don't know if you can remember. He described it as Dial M for Murder meets Final Destination.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he wasn't kidding.
Mm-hmm.
It starts... As we know, it's sort of heading along, you know, a thriller kind of route very happily, a sort of escape the murderer plot. And then he just, like, yanks the steering wheel. but it's kind of cool. And we, it's very unexpected, quite a severe U-turn, but it's very enjoyable as well. It was, you know, you remember that, it reminded me a little bit of that Tarantino...
Dust Till Dawn.
Rodriguez, yeah, exactly, from the mid-90s.
That was crazy, wasn't it? That got everyone, that one.
Yeah, and it starts out as this sort of crime caper, serial killer, drama thing. And then halfway through, it just turns into a gross-out comedy horror.
Yeah.
A sort of self-consciously divided story. And it was a bit like that. But I really enjoyed it. So, well done, Mark. Very good. Very different to anything I've read for a while, certainly.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Thank you very much for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, please go and tell three of your friends that they have to listen to it.
Specifically three friends?
Literally, no more. Don't go more than that, because
okay.
then people... You'll become that person that's always
see.
Talking about that podcast.
Yeah.
Whereas if you just tell one person, it might not hit. We might not get another listener.
That's it,
I think
yeah.
three is a good number for that.
Three's
stop you looking weird and to give us a chance of getting more listeners.
Make it happen, people. Hello.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?